Welcome to the Activation Podcast, brought to you by the Conscious Resistance Network. I'm your host, Derek Brose. In every episode of this podcast, we're going to explore solutions in the areas of health, permaculture, growing your own food, technology. We'll be interviewing guests who are providing important solutions that are more important than ever in this time we are living in. The Activation Podcast is focused on bringing you cutting-edge solutions to empower humanity. Hey everyone, welcome back to the eighth episode of the Activation Podcast. This week we're going to continue our conversations and solutions, try to dive a little deeper into what we're all dealing with in this time that we're facing, things like COVID-19 obviously, and so many other intersecting stories and narratives happening right now. And today, the guest that I'm bringing with you today is an old friend, somebody I've worked with in the past, used to write for his website, Truth and Media. I'm currently on his new platform, sovereign.media. And he's just been one of the most, I'd say, cutting-edge journalists, both in the mainstream and in the independent media, who continue to ask hard-hitting questions despite being censored over the years. I've actually interviewed Ben Swan numerous times. You can go to theconsciousresistance.com and see some of our past interviews. But please welcome today, Ben Swan. How are you doing, brother?
I'm doing great, Derek. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years since we spoke. And I think the last time we spoke was probably, the conversation was about, it was before COVID, I know for sure, that we were talking about ISIS, we were talking about, you know, geopolitics and totally different things from today. But I do want to get into some of your more recent work. You've done a great job. You, myself and many other people within the alternative media, I feel like have really tried to stay on the pulse of what's happening. I know you recently talked with Ryan Christian of Last American Vagabond, who I also work with. He's just, you know, stayed on the minutiae every single day. But I want to talk with you specifically about, you took a trip recently to Europe to cover some of the stories that maybe Americans and just people in North America in generally are not hearing about. So could you tell us a little bit about what prompted this trip to Europe and how long you were out there and what all that entailed?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, I was there for about a month, and the goal was to find out what was happening with lockdowns in Europe. Because, you know, when you were here in the United States, you keep hearing about what's happening around the world, right? You would think that what's taking place is that every country in the world had this very strong response to COVID, that everyone was compliant. But in the United States, it was a big problem because Americans weren't being compliant. If you could just be like the rest of the world, COVID would be over with, right? And I started to see, and I had covered it, by the way, for a couple months before leaving, protests in Ireland, protests in the UK, protests in Australia, and people would send me videos in Germany. There were a lot of protests happening in Germany. And they were sending me videos and saying, hey, these things are happening, and look at these people who are beginning to push back. So I decided, well, I want to go see it for myself. I want to see how people were responding. So I went essentially to four countries. I went to Spain, then to Greece, then to Italy, and then to France was the last one. And those were really chosen based upon what the government was doing at the time in each of those countries. And so I actually was in Italy the day after they instituted the Green Pass, right? And there were a ton of protests over that. People, you know, symbolically burning those Green Pass cards, which if you saw that on Facebook, Facebook fact checkers jumped all over that and said, oh, this is a lie. The Green Pass is digital. This is fake news, right? Not fake news. People were burning in protest. They were obviously, it was symbolic burning, but they would take green pieces of paper and they set them on fire because it was the Green Pass. Right. And so, you know, covering what was happening there and the demonstrations in France, I will say of all the places I was, France was the most interesting to me because the protests there were enormous, hundreds of thousands of people. And they were every single weekend, right, coming out and marching. And in France, it's more than just COVID, right, because as you know, there was a yellow vest. The yellow vest protests had been going on for some time before that. And the yellow vest kind of adopted a lot of the anti a lockdown people. So that movement has grown a lot in France. But I will say this, what was so interesting to me as an American in Europe, right? Europe is not far removed from, you know, just a few decades ago, seeing communism in Eastern Europe, still having a lot of Eastern Europe locked down. Going back to World War II, right? Italy and France and Germany very recently saw what it looks like to see complete authoritarianism and dictators, right? They know what this looks like. And so when you talk to people in those countries, they'll tell you, we know what it looks like. We know what authoritarianism is. You talk to people in Eastern Europe and they'll tell you, because I talked to a lot of those people who were here in the States, and they say, we know exactly what communism is, right? And this is it. And I think as Americans, what's interesting is we don't know what that is. Like, we know on a historical level, we know on an intellectual level, we can look at it and say, well, we understand that this is Marxism, right? That's really what this is. It's Marxism, but we haven't experienced it. We don't have grandparents who sit there and say to us, hey, this is what it looks like when Marxism takes control. What we do have are grandparents who will say, I know what it is to fight communism, right? Or I know what it was to fight. Maybe you have a great grandparent who fought in one of the world wars, and they can tell you what that's like. But we don't really understand what it looks like when an authoritarian regime takes control. And in Europe, they do. They completely understand what it looks like. And I think that's why so many people there are protesting.
Absolutely. So what would you say, Ben, would be like the something just stood out? You know, you named a little bit about each place that you went to, but what was one of the most surprising things you found? Obviously, the first thing is, like you said, the Americans aren't hearing, people from other countries aren't hearing that these protests are happening, unless you're already plugged into the alternative independent media. You know, we see these things, but people in the mainstream are not really going to hear about them. Or if they do, they're told that it's a far right gathering, you know, some right wing extremists. But yeah, what was really surprising or just sort of interesting to you as you traveled across and visited these different protests?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One was, as I mentioned, this idea that people in those countries would say, you know, again, we know what authoritarianism looks like. We know what a dictatorship looks like because we've seen it before, right? We know what Mussolini looked like. We know what Hitler looked like. We know the tactics they took, and it's happening again. So that's why they were, you know, so opposed to it. And you're absolutely right, by the way, when you say, if you watch mainstream, any major broadcast media, or even social media, because if you share pictures of protests, a lot of times they get taken down. When I filed a lot of my reports from Europe and posted them, TikTok was taking them down, Instagram was taking them down, and they were claiming that these were, you know, violent marches or violated their community community standards, because of the fact that they would say, oh, these people are far right or they're, you know, racists or whatever. And so they would come up with these terms of why you couldn't show people marching in the streets there. But one of the things that I also really stood out to me as an American is that when people would find out I was an American, it was the way they perceived what was happening in the United States, right? Which is kind of shocking, because as much as I thought a lot of people in Europe maybe going along and I would see like these pictures of protests, so I wanted to see it. But I think most Americans would think, well, the Europeans are all going along. The Europeans thought the Americans are all going, right? They had no idea that there was resistance to this at all. They thought everyone in the United States is vaccinated. So going to Europe as an unvaccinated American, people were shocked. Like, you're not vaccinated, but you're an American. I'm like, yeah, there are a lot of us who are not vaccinated. In fact, you know, the majority of us are not vaccinated, especially at that time. And so when you hear that, there was a real shock from them. So it's interesting to me from a media perspective that the same bull that the media does over here, right, where they won't tell you what's really happening or they're feeding you this narrative, they're doing it over there as well. And so the one country where there was, I think, the most debate, if you turned on your TV, like they're actually debating it, was in France. Again, I was surprised by this. But in France, if you turn on the TV, every single channel, every news channel, and there's someone debating and there's someone arguing about against lockdowns, against forced vaccination, against vaccine passports. That wasn't the case in any other place, and it certainly isn't the case here in the United States, where they won't allow those debates to take place.
So I want to go a little deeper with this, Ben. I mean, I think that everything we've seen in the last year and a half are some of the things that people like yourself and other journalists have been warning about for a number of years. You know, this didn't just pop up overnight, right? By now, I think most of the audience and most of the people finding their way to this information are aware that COVID-19 is more than about a virus, right? There's an effort to control, the push for the Great Reset, and these kinds of terms that, even without getting conspiratorial, just reading their own words, you know, it's pretty, wow, it's pretty mind-blowing, right? It can be very overwhelming. You know, I've talked to a lot of people across the U.S. I just spent 2 months traveling around the U.S. and doing events and connecting with so many people who, everywhere I was going, people were saying, for one, they had previously felt like they were alone last year, right? But in the last year and a half, I guess people are starting to find each other more through different networks online and in person. And the protests, as you mentioned, they might not be as big as they are in Europe, but they are still happening in parts of the US and other parts of the world. And my point here is that people are connecting at a time when it's so crucial to be connecting, because the world says lockdown, stay home, only talk to each other through Zoom, you know, wear a mask, these kinds of things. People are really, I think, truly seeking a deeper connection. And, you know, with all that insanity, I don't know about you, but I kind of, have been reflecting and really feeling like, I believe personally, you know, take this for what it will, what it is. I'll take it out of the journalism realm for a moment, but just on a personal level, I believe that this is the moment that I'm born for. I believe that this is what we're here for. I believe that this is like a challenge of humanity. And I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that. Like how this, outside of just as a journalist, but really, you know, taking in the full scope of what we're dealing with, that this is an attempt to transform the entire world, the entire, you know, humanity, and how that has been affecting you and how you've been kind of handling that.
Yeah, well, I agree with you that this is a moment that we were born for. What I've told people is I'm actually really grateful. I'm grateful that all of this is happening in this moment. It's happening right now. And the reason for that is because it was going to happen, right? At some point, this was going to happen. Might have been 20 years from now or 30 years from now or 50 years from now. It might have been, had the conditions not been just right, later on in history. But I'm grateful that it's right now, because by it being right now, it's my fight. It's your fight. It's not our children's fight. And it's not our grandchildren's fight, right? So I'm actually grateful that we get to be on the front line of pushing back and saying no to this. We get to be the ones to put our necks out. And we get to be the ones to fight back against it, because I would hate the idea of being an old man who doesn't have the ability to stand up and doesn't have the ability to push back, and watching my kids have to do it and watching my grandkids to have to do it. So I'm really grateful for that. I'm grateful that it's happening in this moment. And I've said this before, Derek, and I really mean this. You know, as you know, I've been trying to wake people up for well over a decade, right? Telling people, you know, this is what's happening and this is what these groups are trying to do, and this is their game plan, and look what the Patriot Act is trying to do, and look at your rights are being taken away, and just trying to wake people up for a long time. And what I truly believe is I could spend another 10 years till I'm blue in the face trying to explain this to people, and nothing was going to wake people up like the jolt that came about over the last 18 months. There are hundreds of millions of people who have awakened over the last 18 months, 2 years now, who have awakened, who would never have woken up because Derek Brose or Ben Swan is speaking out and saying, hey guys, wake up, this is what's going on. They weren't gonna wake up. They weren't gonna see it. And the truth is, there are only two groups of people left, right? Well, there's really three. One is the group who's perpetuating all of this in the first place. But there are people who are awake and see that it's happening. And then the other group are the people who are having to force their eyes closed in order to not see it, right? The only way you don't know what's happening, you don't see that this great reset is on its way, you don't see that they're trying to remake every society from the top down and create a new world order, the terminology they use. That's not my words, as you know. That's the terminology that's being used. The new world order is here, and this is how life is going to be in the new world order. The fact that they're trying to reset all of societies, all economies, all social, you know, structures around the world, the fact that it's happening at the moment that it is and the way it is, the only way you don't believe that is if you're closing your eyes, you're shuttering a corner, and you're hoping that they'll just go away. It's like a little kid in their room at night, right? Afraid of the monster. You close your eyes and you hide and you just pretend that nothing bad is happening because you just want the monster to go away. And I just keep my eyes closed, it can't hurt me. There are a lot of people who are still in that place, but not many of them. Most people have awakened to the fact that they realize this is reality. This is what's really happening.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, Ben, that I believe there are more people than I've seen in the 12 years that I've been, you know, doing activism on kind of a full-time and independent journalism. I've never seen as many people asking these questions. And you're right. I think that, you know, we'll get into what you're doing with Sovereign in a moment. But, you know, I really believe that it's really crazy to see this awakening happening, and at the same time seeing them try to censor harder than ever, right? I think that's really kind of the beautiful thing, is like them trying harder than ever. They purged so many of us from Facebook back in 2018, and then they started doing these other ways. They're taking people off Patreon and PayPal and really trying to just limit your ability to exist and to report and to put some food on the table in any way. Yeah. And despite that, new platforms are popping up. People are finding ways to communicate. You know, people are still meeting face to face. I can say personally in my realm, the Freedom Cell Network has been growing. We went from the beginning of COVID, like a couple thousand people, to now 27,000 plus people around the world that are just using the website and Telegram to connect, to meet in real world, to start growing food together. People are pulling their kids out of school together. People are pulling their money out of the banks. They're buying land. They're really thinking about what kind of steps that they need to take to continue to thrive into the future. And that sort of brings me to the next question for you, you know, whatever you feel comfortable sharing. How has the last 18 months really changed your life and your family's experience? You know, for me, I had planned to come down to Mexico eventually and buy some land and start this community idea. And when COVID happened, my partner Miriam and I, we decided, you know what, they're talking about restricting interstate travel. Let's get the heck out of here. Let's go visit family in Mexico. And then we saw what was happening. We decided just, you know, why wait another 5 years? Let's just start now. Let's start looking for land now. And so we've been down here. And I know a lot of other people have made big changes, whether moving or losing jobs, just all kinds of things. But how has it personally impacted you or maybe the path that you were on before COVID, if anyway?
Yeah, what's kind of funny about that is it actually hasn't. It hasn't affected me at all. And there's a couple of reasons for that. You know, I had begun to secede from the banking system and first got involved in crypto and wanting to get away from the fiat dollar 8 years ago, right? So that for me, that was a long journey. I was already out of that. I have five kids and I had been homeschooling for 15 years and they have never been a part of that system, right? So when people are saying, oh my gosh, you know, pull your kids out of school, done. They were never in. They've been homeschooled by me for 15 years. So, and my wife, and so the two of us have done that already. And so, you know, the commute for people and, oh, what are you going to do about your job? Guess what? I work for myself from home. So it doesn't affect me. Right. And so what's been really interesting, my kids, I remember when this all first started and the lockdown started and they were saying, how is this going to impact us? And I'm like, the truth is the whole world is just about to start living the way that we live. Right. That's what's interesting. Is, and it's not so scary, by the way, as I think people are finding out, right? They thought, how would we ever survive without our kids being in school every day? Well, they can do a lot of school and they can become much more educated outside of that system than they ever would be inside the system. And there are people who are starting to find that out and saying, oh my God, it's not that scary. It's not that hard. You know, the idea that maybe I'm not going to have to go commute every day and punch this clock and live the way that I've been told that I have to live. There's a different way. And so again, I've been living that different way now for a long time. And so for me, it didn't change anything. Life went on literally exactly the same way. The only difference is, you know, when all of a sudden, if you're going to get on an airplane, you have to put on one of these stupid masks that doesn't work. You know, those kinds of little inconveniences. But for the most part, it doesn't change anything. And I believe this too. If you are in a, and I think you know this is true, if you're in any kind of society or space in the world where you're not listening to broadcast media and CNN, if you're not listening to some totalitarian mayor or governor who's trying to, you know, enforce all these ridiculous restrictions on you, you wouldn't even know that there was a pandemic. Right? Most people are able to just live and say, so what's happening? What's going on that's so shocking to the world? Because I don't feel anything different. And I think that's the reality of most of our lives. And so the more you're outside of the system, the less power they have to be able to create an uncomfortable system. And that's been a lot of this. A lot of this tactic, a lot of this strategy was about making your life difficult. And that's still happening, by the way, in order to punish the unvaccinated. That's the new step we're in right now, right? Which is we're going to come up with all these different ways where we're going to make life as difficult as possible for people who are unvaccinated so they will comply. Well, one way that you prevent them from making your life so difficult is don't be a part of their systems. And as soon as you're not part of those systems, they don't really have any leverage over you anymore. It's just simply not there.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned that point, Ben, because that's just so important to, you know, the work that I try to do and the message that I try to share. And this is even prior to COVID. And here we are now. And I think a lot more people are realizing, wait, maybe I don't want to be as plugged into these systems as I thought I need to. And some people have built their whole lives, like kids in school, stuck on the, you know, the banking system, or maybe they're dependent on Social Security check or a veterans check. And now people are trying to think, how do I navigate this? How am I going to stay free if they make my bank account contingent on my vaccination status? Or how am I going to renew my license? All these different things. And ultimately, I believe that this is really presenting us with the opportunity to create parallel structures and parallel societies. And you mentioned crypto. Crypto is a big part of that. And yeah, I mean, for those who don't know, but I mean, that was one of the first things we worked together on back in 2014 or something. It was the Texas, you were doing a Texas tour and I was following along and documenting everything. And when I started working with Truth in Media, you would pay me in crypto. You know, you were one of the first crypto payments I got back in 2013, 2014. So this is something we've been talking about for a while. And now a lot more of the public is aware, obviously. A lot more of the mainstream is aware of this. But at the same time, we do see that the Great Resetters, part of their agenda, does include digital currency, not cryptocurrency, because there's a difference, you know, as you know, but a digital currency, central bank digital currencies, tracked and traced, monitored on a blockchain, but not in the way that we have talked about. So why don't we talk a little bit about that, like your relationship with crypto, your thoughts on where it's headed, and, you know, some of the positives versus the, you know, their vision.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, you set it up perfectly there. I think the reality is that, first of all, every central bank in the world will soon have a digital currency. All currency will become digital very soon. It's moving at a kind of an accelerated pace to get there. The U.S. is slow and they're behind, but they are headed toward it. And when you hear the Federal Reserve Chairman, Jay Powell, get up and say, well, you know, we'll see if we ever get there. They are actively working right now to get there. They're going to get there. So the question is, how do you navigate in a world that's all digital? Well, there's two things. Number one is decentralized currencies versus centralized currencies. So a central bank, hence the name central bank, a central bank backed currency, right, a CBDC, is basically just digital money that you'll never control. It will be completely controlled by governments, and they can just take it from you anytime they want, right? This whole idea of the IRS going through all of your bank statements, if you make more than $600 and they're going to review everything in the future, that's the IRS's wet dream, right? That they're going to have a digital currency that they can just take out of your bank account or remove from you, or debit from you with no problem. And so for folks who are out there trying to figure out, well, what does this look like? Well, one thing you need to do is you need to get involved in cryptocurrencies. The more private, the better, obviously, because, you know, you don't want to be tracked and traced. But then here's the other thing. If you are involved in crypto and you're using Coinbase or you're using Kraken or you're using crypto.com, right? And you're saying, well, I'm using Robinhood and I'm buying my crypto and I've got it in my wallet and it's safe. It's not in your wallet. If you use any of those exchanges and you keep your crypto in an exchange, you're not, that's literally coming to me and saying, here's my crypto, right? Or here's my money. Hold it for me and you let me have it when I'm ready for it. That's all you're doing. You do not control that wallet. The wallet belongs to the exchange. And so what you have to learn how to do is go to get a cold storage wallet and you literally take your crypto and you move it offline and you keep it. You do not keep it in an exchange. Because again, that's really what the government wants at this point, is to get as many people funneled into those systems as possible, because then when they're ready to monitor you, trace you, track you, tax you, you know, deduct from you, take from you because you had a thought crime that they're now going to penalize you for, whatever they want to do, if your money is sitting in a crypto exchange, I don't care if you like the exchange, if you think they're good people, none of that matters. If it's in an exchange, it's not yours. Somebody else has it. And right now, that's one of the big problems with the banking system, right? You put your money in a bank, it's not your money, it's the bank's money. The bank does whatever they want to do with it. They spend your money, they loan your money, and they'll give you back your money if you're not breaking the rules. If the government tells them not to give you back your money, you know a bank won't do it. It's the same thing with a crypto exchange. So you got to get smart about that. If you're in these spaces, yeah, obviously, if you're cashing out crypto, you're going to do it through an exchange. If you're trying to exchange crypto for another crypto, you're probably going to do that through an exchange. But don't leave your crypto sitting in an account. You need to remove it and take it offline.
Yeah, absolutely there. And Ben, what would you say to the critics out there, right? I'm sure you've noticed this within the truth community, freedom community, liberty community, that there are those who wholeheartedly embrace crypto. And I would even say some who failed, who have some blind spots for the problems, you know, and the different, there's a lot of shady characters in the crypto space, and I've written some articles on that. Some of them are totally tied to a lot of these agendas and pushing some of the same agendas. But there's also the decentralized, like you said, privacy coins and things like that. And I've noticed over the last really year, it seems like, because of certain researchers out there who are very much like adamantly against crypto and things like that and blockchain, that there's a whole, you know, slew of the audience that, for one, they don't really seem to understand it, but they're afraid of it. And because they hear them talk of digital currency and they hear about the negative uses of putting children on the blockchain or all these kind of things, they're like, oh, anything blockchain, anything crypto, or anything digital, right? It's got to be bad. What would you say to those folks?
Well, listen, I think, again, you set it up really well there, because the reality is, with every technology, there are good and evil uses for it, right? Technology is not good, nor is technology evil, ever. It's just a tool. A hammer is never good, nor is it ever evil, right? The person who wields the hammer is the one who decides what it's used for, to build or to tear down, to build or to kill. And so you can't blame blockchain or digital currencies as being an inherently evil thing. How are they used, and whether or not they're used to create freedom or used to create totalitarianism, that's up to the user. So one of the things that is important to remember, though, is that blockchain itself can be misused. But if it's used the right way, then it creates a counterbalance to these evil systems that are in place. Like, if you say, well, I think blockchain is terrible, do you think it's more terrible than the banking system? Do you actually believe that the banking systems that for centuries have funded immoral wars and have been the center of organized crime, whether they be government cabals or cartels, whatever it might be, right? Banks have been at the center of all of that for centuries. So you're telling me that blockchain or cryptocurrency is more evil? Now, you might potentially say, but I think the evil people might utilize blockchain in a more evil way. And you might be right. That might be true. But that doesn't make blockchain evil. It means that they're utilizing that technology. But here's the reality. They're going to utilize that technology, whether there is a good purpose or not. So what we have to do is say, how are we utilizing this tool in a way to counteract what they're doing, right? How do we take centralized technologies and decentralize them to give the power back to people? If we're not willing to do that, then all we're doing is just rolling over, or we're running and hiding. And so you can't win a war by hiding. We're never going to win a war of attrition, where we just have to go and pretend that bad things aren't happening around us, and the people around us who are corrupt and wicked aren't doing wicked things, right? You're not going to win by doing that or trying to avoid them. At some point, there has to be a war of confrontation in which you confront these things. And the only way we can win that war right now is by no longer operating within the same internet and centralized technological structures that have been in place. Because so far, throughout even just recent human history, we have this ebb and flow of certain things will happen, right? And it creates lots of freedom. And then that same technology is turned around and used to create oppression. And then we get to a new level and it creates freedom. And then there's oppression. Freedom and oppression. We keep going through the cycle. At some point, though, we have to recognize that the same technological tools that are creating oppression can be used to create freedom. And at some point, we have to be able to get to use it for that. So I understand people who are concerned about it. I really do. I think you have reason to be concerned. But the answer is not to abandon technology. It's to use that tool to defend and protect the people.
Hold that thought. Guys, before we go any further, I want to tell you a little bit about a project that I recently launched called the Holistic Self-Assessment Online Course. Now, some of you know that I released this book, The Holistic Self-Assessment, in April 2018. And essentially, this book is the culmination of the experiences I had when I went to prison, dealing with addiction, dealing with depression, and suicide attempts. This is the process that I took myself through to get to know who I am, to get to know my principles, to get to align my relationships, my words, my thoughts, and actions with those principles. Overall, it's meant to be a self-empowerment, self-help guide that can help you start accomplishing your goals by aligning your principles with your actions. The book is available to download for free, and I'll include that link below. But if you're interested, I did recently launch a new online course, which you can find on the University of Reason, aka Autonomy. I partnered with them recently, and they created this whole online course for me. It's 9 weeks long. You can watch and follow along and read the book as I go through each chapter. I read it with you, and I offer some tips and some exercises. There are two different options. You can either do DIY, where you just go through the 9-week course yourself, or if you want to have personal one-on-one sessions with me, there's also an option for that. So check that out, guys. I'll include both links below. Let's get back to the podcast.
Yeah, because I mean, the same thing could essentially be said about the internet and social media itself, right? Because the internet connections to DARPA, social media, DARPA, intelligence communities, all these things, we could just have thrown our hands up and say, that's their tool, we're never going to use it. And we never would have created the movements we have today, right? There wouldn't be these whole kind of ecosystem of podcasts and shows and all this stuff, if we had just given it over to them. So I do think that that's ultimately what everybody should remember, is it's a tool. You don't have to participate in the tool if you don't want to. If you're not interested in crypto, that's fine, but you should definitely seek some form of alternative. If you're going to do precious metals, if you're going to create your own paper currency or barter networks or whatever have you, but you should have some sort of, you know, method of getting out of their financial system, because it's such a big component to what we're facing, right?
But then, and to that point, if you are a person who says, I am anti-crypto and I'm anti, you know, all of that, but you are still using fiat dollars, U.S., you know, Federal Reserve dollars, how's that an answer?
That's definitely a big one to me. And it's not even meant to be like a sort of gotcha. It's just like, hey, think about this. Are you using the banking system? You got Bank of America, but you're like, oh, crypto is bad. It's like, you need to rethink, you know, what you're doing there. But ultimately the answer is, as you said, to create decentralized parallel systems to what they're doing. And this is something that you've been focused on for years now with social media, with video platforms. And I'm sure some listeners will be familiar with the previous incarnation, which was ice.media, and now has kind of been relaunched in the last couple months as sovereign.media. Could you tell us a little bit about the decision to make that change and what's new with Sovereign? What's the purpose of the change?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we first launched ISC.media, the goal of that was to eventually get to where we are now. And so ISC was kind of just a landing page for video content. And it was, you know, just a few of us who were posting video there. The goal of Sovereign is to launch a full-on, really strong and vibrant online social media community. Everything from streaming video to social media platforms similar to Facebook to social media groups, right? One thing that there's a lot of competitors out there, right? Guys like Rumble who are coming along and they're like, hey, we're going to be the new YouTube. And that's great. Right. No criticism there. But one thing they're lacking the social aspect of social media. The thing that gave Facebook so much power, that made them such a powerful company, was not just the ability to create content and place it there. It was the ability of communities to interact with each other, sharing content and communicating with each other. So as a quick example, I'm actually in DC right now. That's why I'm coming to you from this Batcave. But I was here in DC a week ago. And I was covering a vaccine injury roundtable, and it was put on by Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. And a number of people who were here were talking about the fact that they were involved in the Pfizer trials and describing their injuries, horrific injuries as a result of the vaccines that they were given. And one of the things that they shared, every single one of them shared, was the experience of going online because they felt so isolated. And they were being so gaslit by their own doctors telling them, there's nothing wrong with you, or you just have anxiety. You know, people with paralysis, in terrible nerve damage, in extreme pain. They can feel, as they described it, water running down the inside of their arm after getting that second Pfizer shot. And so what they did was they went online and they went to Facebook and started looking for anybody else out there who had the same thing. And what they found was there were thousands upon tens of thousands of people in Facebook groups describing the same injury, saying, this is what happened to me. This is the impact that it had on me. And there was one guy who gave kind of his experience, and he was a nurse prior to this, by the way. And so he's explaining that as a nurse, this is what he went through, and he was describing it and saying how difficult it was. And he went online and he found this community of people with the exact same issues that he was having. And so as a nurse, he began sharing with them different ways that they could help themselves, different ways they could relieve some of their symptoms and feel better. And there were, I think in his particular group that he was in, there were 3,500 of them. And he described at the point that Facebook decided they were all liars and that none of this was real and deleted their group, right? And so all those people who were spread out all across the country and possibly in various parts of the world. I don't even know if they were all in the United States. But these people, 3,500 people in this one group, and there was another group that had 10,000, another group that had 30,000, and they were in these groups, and these people had found connection, right, in this shared experience of two things happening. One, injury as a result of the vaccine, but two, they had this shared connection of being told nothing is wrong with you. You're crazy if you think there's something wrong and no one's going to listen to you. And so they have found this connection with each other. And then the power of social media was the ability of these people to connect and to find each other. And then the ability that we're talking about technology being misused, the ability of Facebook to come in and just hammer these people and cast them into the wind where they can't find each other again, right? Because all of a sudden, boom, they're all disconnected from each other. And so one of the things that I'm really committed to with Sovereign, we have a new feature that'll be coming out by the first of the year. It's called Sovereign Circles. And it's basically groups where people can get and connect with each other and communicate with each other, because it is so critically important that we keep the integrity of what makes social media powerful, and that is the social component. I'm a video content creator, you're a video content creator. I know that we believe that the most important thing that we do is to communicate, and that's great. But I also recognize that the most important thing that people have in this moment is the ability to communicate with each other, whether that's sharing content, sharing video, or just talking to each other. And so that's something that we're really committed to doing with this project.
Is there a plan? I know that it was discussed in the past with ISC, but is there a plan to incorporate blockchain into Sovereign, or is that something that's on the horizon?
Absolutely, it is. So that's what we are building towards, is that our entire platform will be on the blockchain, for those of you who hate blockchain. Here's why it's significant to be on the blockchain. So as we're building this out, one thing that makes Sovereign completely unique from any other entity that's out there, and there are a bunch of folks who are trying to create different platforms right now. What makes us different is that we are building completely outside of Silicon Valley. We are not using their servers. We're not using their technology. We're building everything outside of that, including our apps are being built outside of that system. So right now, there's a whole bunch of people out there, right, who are creating new social media. And Trump says he's got his social media coming out next year. And there's a brand new one that Glenn Greenwald just talked about. I think it's called Colin or something that is coming out. All of these are being built on Apple's App Store. And I know you know, Derek, Apple and Google, right? Two of the worst companies in the world. And they will delete your app at the moment they think that they have enough people in there to discourage them. What they're going to do is they're going to let you bring all these people in. They're going to let you recruit all these users. They're going to let you build communities. And then the moment that you have momentum and it feels good, they're going to shut it down because they can. Because there is absolutely no legal requirement of Google or Apple to allow you to be on their Play Stores. They will decide you have violated their terms of service. And by the way, some of these new sites that are coming along are already putting in their terms of service, no content will be allowed here that violates Apple or Google's terms of service. It's like, so then what are you? You're just YouTube again. That's all you're building. You're trying to build your platform, right, on somebody else's real estate. You're building it on their land, their property, and they will kick you off because you are violating their ability to control the masses. And so I feel bad for anyone who's doing it right now, because it's the wrong way to do it. Now, maybe they'll prove me wrong. Maybe they'll prove that Apple and Google are actually really benevolent companies that want truth out there. But if they were those companies, they wouldn't have done all the things they've already done. So everything we're doing is to build through the blockchain, decentralized servers, and ultimately, our company will be completely decentralized from the governance side of it, meaning that the company itself in the future will belong to the people. It will not belong to a board of directors. It will never go through an IPO, and it will never go through an acquisition. It will ultimately become a DAO, a decentralized autonomous organization, and it will belong to the people.
That's awesome. I love that idea. And, just a couple of the things you mentioned there are just sort of a reminder to the listener who might not even think in these terms. These are the other alternatives we need to build, right? Not just the search engines and the social media, but the app store, right? I mean, and there are some decentralized open source versions out there for Android users, might be familiar with the FDroid store and some of those, but they're still not mainstream enough, right? Because these companies just have that monopoly. If you want to go get a privacy phone or a non-Microsoft, non-Google, non-Apple computer, you got to go out of your way. You got to make the effort to make it happen. You can't just find, the Clear phone or the Above phone or the Purism or these different alternatives that are kind of creeping in at the Verizon store, at the team, you have to make an effort. And that's sort of, I think, what is a roadblock for a lot of people. But thankfully, people like yourself and others are creating those alternatives. You mentioned Glenn Greenwald, man, and you just kind of made me think of a question that I would like to get into for a moment as we wrap up here. And that really is just the state of journalism, right? You yourself are an award-winning journalist, originally doing some award-winning journalism in Texas down by the border. And I'd say a lot of your other work is deserving of awards. I think you deserve a Hall of Fame just for questioning Obama about drones to his face. Like, that to me is still a classic clip for those who haven't seen that. And, you know, for someone like me, I'm a self-taught journalist. I've taken some supplemental journalism classes just to learn a little bit of the vernacular and whatnot. But sometimes I question myself. I'm like, maybe things aren't as corrupt as I imagine, right? And then I see people like yourself, Glenn Greenwald, and others who have spent time in the mainstream doing great work to call out some of the different biases. We're seeing those with the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, you know, people realizing, holy crap, maybe I hadn't actually known what was really happening. I was just believing lies because I didn't really look into this. You see the raiding of James O'Keefe and Project Veritas and, you know, taking, like, there's some really worrisome things going on.
Yeah.
I'd like to get you just your thoughts from, you know, you, like I said, you have more experience in that quote unquote mainstream kind of corporate journalism. I mean, has it just lost its mind or has it always been this way? I mean, why is it just the
no,
war on journalism is so blatant?
Yeah, I think it's always been this way. I really do. I think that the difference is, listen, for as long as there has been a corporate media structure, it's been this way. Remember that, you know, if you go back to our original Bill of Rights, one of the First Amendment rights that we have is the freedom of press, right? And people misinterpret that as being a freedom of a profession. It's not, right? The press was anyone who could publish, anyone who could share information however they could, whether they wrote it out by hand or they own their own little printing press and they could write it and they could create it. You have freedom to disseminate information. That's what the right is. It's not a right of a corporation. And but as long as there's been a corporate media, I think it's been corrupt. Look, we know that even going back into what the 50s and 60s and 70s, Project Mockingbird by the CIA, which was meant to, you know, influence newsrooms and control what was going on. We know that the way the media covered things in recent history, like the Gulf of Tonkin incident or weapons of mass destruction to get us most recently into that war in Iraq. So we know that the media is corrupt. The difference between now and then is that for generations, there was no method by which to reveal their corruption. So if you were a reporter and you saw corruption, or if you knew that there was corruption, how did you share that information? Right? You might tell the people in your small personal circle, but you had no ability to share that. Maybe you could write a book if you could get it published, but if you couldn't, there's no self-publishing. Right? You can't, how do you get information out? There's no way. And so what has changed, and this goes back to the technology issue, right? So the evil of technology allows media to lie about a Kyle Rittenhouse by completely concocting a story and details about him and then lambasting him for well over a year about being a school shooter, white supremacist who wanted to went there hunting black men and killing peaceful protesters, right? That's what people were told. The difference is that 30 years ago or 40 years ago, no one would know otherwise, right? But the difference is you have journalists, anybody's a journalist today, and I don't mean that in a flippant way, because we're all walking around with recording devices, right? We're all walking around with them. And so when you have people recording, one thing that's absolutely stunning, and history should look back on the Kyle Rittenhouse trial as unique in a couple ways. One is you have so much video from that night, so many different vantage points of exactly what happened. When you see that, oh, wait a minute, all the victims were white guys. Oh, wait, all the victims were monsters. Right. They weren't just white guys. They weren't peaceful protesters. They were violent people with long and lengthy criminal histories who were now going to murder Kyle Rittenhouse if they gotten their hands on him. And when you watch the videos, listen, people can debate it all they want. But when you watch the videos, there's no doubt these guys were trying to hurt him. Even the prosecutors didn't deny that in court because of the video. They said stupid things like, well, he was too much of a coward to fight him with his fists. And they put up a picture from a Patrick Swayze movie. Like, what the fuck was that? That was complete nonsense. But the point being that the reason that you saw prosecutors make the case the way they did was because the video was out there. It was introduced. People had recorded it. And then it's being shared and disseminated all across the internet, which I got to tell you a quick story about that. So a year ago, I was one of the first journalists who was handed a piece of video that showed all of this. I didn't know anything about the Kyle Rittenhouse story. I didn't know anything about what happened that night. Just, again, what I had heard, which is that some kid drove across state lines with a gun and shot at people in Kenosha. And then I get sent this video saying this came out today, and this is a video showing all these different vantage points of exactly what happened to the people involved. Blew my mind. Absolutely incredible stuff. So I put it up on Facebook and we heavily shadow banned it because it was right at kind of at the height of when Kyle Rittenhouse had first been arrested. And it had about 16,000 views on it, right? It didn't do anything. Then yesterday, I'm working on something and I notice on my Facebook page that I have something that's spiking. And so I go and look at what is spiking here. And I see it's this same video that shows all this video vantage points of exactly what happened that night. It's done 1.1 million views in 24 hours, right? From Tuesday night into Wednesday. So I'm like, oh my gosh, somebody must have shared this. Somehow this is out and it's like blowing up, going viral. So I'm like sharing it on different social media and just saying, hey, by the way, a lot of people are seeing this video. I even forgot that we had this video, but if you want to see it, watch it. Within less than 30 minutes, Facebook deletes the video and then puts up a warning on my page that says, you violated our community standards. You've been banned from live streaming and monetizing videos for the next 30 days. Right. And it's like, wait a minute. All I'm doing is sharing a video that's already up and it's getting attention. But I guess because it was getting enough attention, it flagged the you know, trolls at Facebook who jumped on it and tried to kill it. The point of that being that what we see happening right now is that the people, all of us, right, have the ability to communicate and share information like no other time in history. So the power of CNN or NBC to sit there and tell you that this is what happened, trust us because we're trustworthy. There, I'm sure you've seen them. There's a whole bunch of memes right now that show one story after another that the media hasn't just gotten wrong. That's a nice way of putting it. Has deliberately lied and manipulated over the last couple of years, major news stories that have been proven to be untrue. And what it demonstrates is not that the media is more dishonest than they used to be. What it reveals is that the people have the ability to find out what the truth is. And that's the reason we know they've lied about these things. Because you know what's not on that list is things like weapons of mass destruction and the war in Iraq in the first place, right? None of that stuff's on there. Well, we didn't even have the ability to communicate about that war. Remember, back when the Iraq war happened in, 2003, you had one guy in cable news who said, this is a lie. And that was a guy named Phil Donahue. He had the number one show on MSNBC at the time. And NBC fired him and said, you're not going to say that on the air, right? There was no one on the internet really talking about this unless you were on some like little chat room, but it didn't have reach, right? And so I think that's what's changed. What's changed is not that the media has become more corrupt. It's that the people have been able to see them for what they really are in a way that they never had in the past. And the good thing about that is we can never go back. You can never go back to regaining that trust. The only way you'll regain the trust is to actually tell the truth. And they're not going to do that.
So just one kind of cap on that, Ben, and we'll wrap up with one final question. But is this something that you feel like, looking back, you feel like you were aware of all this in your journalism career? Or did you start waking up when you were reporting on the Ron Paul campaign, kind of noticing all those lies there?
Yeah, no, for me, it really started just before that, when I was covering the drug war in Mexico and I saw how many lies were being told by media about that. And I was like, but I'm literally here. I'm covering this every day. I'm in the most violent city in the world and watching what's happening that's destroying people's lives. And you know, they were just lying about it every time they come down. And then when I got to Ohio and started covering politics in the Ron Paul campaign, saw how they were lying about him. And so the question for me was, but why are they lying about it, right? It's not just, yeah, they are lying. That became clear, but then it was why. And when you start to find out why, oh, well, this is his stance on this and this and this, then you wake up and as they say, you go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, because he was definitely one of the only people still even trying to have any sort of anti-war message, and you know, Federal Reserve, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the final question I want to ask you, you know, just to sort of, we're on this mid-November right now. We're on the cusp of 2022. Right now, parts of Europe are starting to do lockdowns for the unvaccinated. Austria, Germany, the UK is considering it. This, to me, seems to be the next trend in the COVID-1984, as some of us call it. You know, we had the first wave of lockdowns, the mask mandates. Now we're getting places rolling out proof of vaccination, vaccine passports. And now it seems like we're at the point of lockdowns for the unvaccinated. If you can, you know, impart a little bit of hope to those out there who are facing that. Maybe somebody listening is right now, maybe they're in Austria and they're already locked down. Yeah. Maybe this is a potential to happen in the United States. You know, what would you say to any listener out there who sees these kinds of measures on the horizon and is really trying to figure out how they can stay motivated, activated, and really see whatever solutions are available to us.
Yeah, well, I'd say a couple of things. In the United States, if you're in the United States, I would say if you start to see this coming into your state, you need to pack up, you need to leave. You need to go someplace where they're not going to do it. So I know there's a lot of talk about like Florida and Ron DeSantis in Florida. In Texas, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it'll happen in Georgia where I live. And the reason for that is because there would be, I think, such a strong backlash to that. The positive is this. It's a positive and it's a negative. The positive is time is very short for these people in terms of their ability to continually force this lie. So for instance, I know a lot of people who have been vaccinated, right? A lot of them. And what they'll tell me is now, I'm sure you guys have seen, that Biden and his administration are about to go ahead and basically order that booster shot, right? So now, to be fully vaccinated, you have to be given 3 shots, not 2. That's about to happen. And I know a lot of people who have been vaccinated twice who say, no way, I am not getting vaccinated again, right? They're not going to keep giving me these boosters. So they didn't like the experience when they had it before. And they're like, I'm out. I'm done. That's all I'm doing. The positive of that is there are a lot of lies that are falling apart. The lie that, number one, that COVID is the most dangerous virus in the world. That lie is falling apart. It's been falling apart. Number two, that the only way to get out of it is to be vaccinated. That lie has completely fallen apart. Number three, that if you're unvaccinated, you're going to die. That's obviously falling apart. And that's one reason they're pushing for mandatory vaccination. Because as long as people are unvaccinated, right, and a significant portion of the population is unvaccinated, then what will start to happen is you're going to see two things. One is the number of people who are hospitalized and dying from COVID among the unvaccinated continues to drop, and it continues to go up among the vaccinated. Why? Because people who are unvaccinated who are getting COVID, CDC numbers now show 145 million people had COVID in the United States. 145 million, which means 145 million people pretty much can't get it again. So those of us who are fine, I think we're okay just continuing to take our chances. What we're seeing in the UK right now, just a statistic for you. In the last 7 weeks, 63% of all the people hospitalized or dying from COVID were fully vaccinated. In the last 4 weeks, that number jumped to 78%. So 78% of the people hospitalized or dying from COVID are double vaxxed, right? And so what does that tell us? Well, it tells us not only do the vaccines not prevent you from getting sick, not only do they not prevent you from spreading COVID, but they're not protecting people from even dying from it. In fact, what we might find out is it's making people more susceptible. Don't have all the information on that, but there's a lot of research that's starting to indicate that that may be the case, that it's actually making people more susceptible to the actual virus when they get it. Now, that's significant because that means that in a very short amount of time, when that happens, you're going to lose control of the population that says, well, we were on your side, right, to punish anyone who wasn't vaccinated, but look what it's doing to us, right? The other thing is, as we mentioned, there's a lot of vaccine injury out there that's not been reported and it's been hidden from the public. The reason that's significant is because if you hide that from the public, at some point, you're going to start to see it. Because people will know people who have been injured. I know a ton of people who have been injured, who have family members who have been injured. And they'll talk about, you know, what they've been through. And so the reason, again, that that's important is because that means time is short before all of that veil comes off. So what I would say to people is if you're out there and you're thinking, man, I guess I'm not going to be able to hold on. Hold on as long as you possibly can. Hold on. Because the truth is that as the veil comes off of these lies, the people who are perpetrating it are going to not only lose favor with the public, but they lose their power. They're going to lose their power. There's no question. And they are the ones who are panicked right now. So don't be part of that. The people who are the most panicked right now are the people with the most power, because they know that power is going to be taken from them when they're proven to be liars. It's why they're moving at a breakneck pace right now to try to force compliance from everyone. Hold your ground. Stay with it. Because I believe, truly believe, in a very short amount of time, all the masks are coming off.
Thank you so much, Ben Swan, for joining us today here on the Activation Podcast. You know, I always appreciate our conversations, Ben. You've been a big inspiration journalistically and just, you know, as a person over the years. So I appreciate you continuing to do what you're doing. And, you know, I appreciate you taking time on the Activation Podcast. Is sovereign.media the best place to send people to keep up with your work?
Absolutely. To keep up with my work and for them to sign up and get a username and to keep up with hopefully your work there, Ryan's work. I mean, there's a lot of folks who are coming over. But also, not just to keep up with our work, to build a community. Go there, get on, and start building a community within that space. Because one thing that will make us different, we're not going to be stealing your data. We're not going to be cataloging you, chronicling you, and sharing your information with the government. This is truly a free speech place.
Absolutely. And I'm already over there at The Conscious Resistance. You guys can find my videos there. So thank you again, Ben, for your time. Thank you guys for listening. This has been the Activation Podcast. Until next time, remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free.
Thank you for listening to the Activation Podcast, brought to you by the Conscious Resistance Network. You can find the archives of our show on Spotify, Pinecast, and at theconsciousresistance.com. Thanks for listening.